Welcome back to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. I'm Alex Grant. Today, I'm joined by mystery and science fiction novelist and writer Alex Segura. We're here to discuss his own personal history in comics, as well as his new release, Secret Identity, a novel. Alex, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Like I told you many times, I'm a fan of the podcast, and it's a real treat to be a guest.
Oh, well, thank you. Now, a lot of people don't know you currently live in New York. You're senior vice president at Oni Press, and you just released this book, Secret Identity, which I loved. Thank you for mentioning the podcast in your acknowledgments. That was super kind. And I just kind of want to mention a little something about it before we get started on your own history in comics. It's an interesting concept with this almost unintentional ghostwriter and all that ensues in the 1975 comic book industry. It's a genius concept. The interesting thing is the idea of an unintentional ghostwriter and their secret identity as the actual writer. I just love the title. I love the concept. But before we go into that, let's talk about your own history, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
You're Cuban American, right? That comes up in a lot of your writings. You're born in 1980 in Miami, Florida. Tell us about growing up as a kid in 1980, the political situation of Cuba. How did that affect your growing up, your parents? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, my parents came over from Cuba shortly after, obviously they hadn't met yet, but after the Castro takeover in 1960, my mom was born, her birthday is January 1st. So she has vivid memories of her party, her birthday party being interrupted by the news of Castro taking over. So they came over. I was born in 1980, and there was always this kind of sense of other, like of another place that was home, but we'd never see, you know, like this idea that my family, like many other Cuban families, had been uprooted and taken away. So a lot of like Cuban goes on, a lot of, you know, it was always top of the news in Miami, as I'm sure it continues to be, what was happening in Cuba. It was very much this sense of like detachment. Like we were here in Miami and everything else was going, you know, other stuff was going on in Cuba that we just weren't part of because of this, you know, this man. A lot of the blame was laid out on Castro and his takeover. And it was an interesting way to grow up because I think it was fairly unique. I don't know. It didn't feel it very unique to me in that home was Miami, but there was also another home that I'd never get to see. And I grew up a comic reader. I mean, my first comic was an Archie comic. I remember my mom picking it up for me at the grocery store at Publix. I think we were in the checkout aisle and I was about 5 or 6. And I just remember the Archie stuff presented this Americana that I wasn't really familiar with. Like in Miami, you don't have seasons, you know, it's always great weather. You know, it's culturally a melting pot and just so different from, you know, the Archie Americana was very appealing because everyone was friends. It was just this very happy-go-lucky scenario. And it was a great introduction to comics because the stories were sitcom-ish, you know, in terms of format. You know, there was no continuity. There was no overarching, you know, there were some dramatic stories. I remember those particularly, like usually drawn by Stan Goldberg or, you know, they'd feature the kids in some kind of peril. Those were fun, the Life with Archie stories, but I really was drawn to the sitcom and the clean art style, like DiCarlo and Harry Lucy and things like that. I obviously didn't know that, those creator names, until much later. And then my first superhero comic was a reprint of, you probably remember this, the Spectacular Spider-Man magazine, you know, those two issues that Stan and Romita did. I think the first issue was in black and white, but the second issue was in color.
That's right.
And it's still one of, I think, the best Green Goblin stories ever in terms of, you know, Norman Osborn is still around. Still had his amnesia, and this is funny in retrospect, but they opened the story with somebody, J. Jonah Jameson, showing a film on the Green Goblin.
Yeah.
And so Norman Osborn, of course, then goes into like a cold sweat and becomes the Green Goblin. But
and that wasn't J. Jonah Jameson, but that was Captain Stacy, right?
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah, you're right.
I love that issue. You're right. It's a great issue.
It's so good. And Romita, you know, drew everyone beautifully, but when he drew terror or like sheer anger, he was he's so gifted. And I read that around the same time I picked up the Archie comics, and that really opened the door to superhero stuff, and I became, you know, I was obsessed, and then I became like a regular visitor to my newsstand. And then when I discovered there was a comic shop down the street from my grandparents' house, dearly departed Frank's Comics and Cards, I would make myself known there whenever I had a couple dollars to rub together.
And that's an interesting transition from Archie having the Romita Lee Spider-Man be the gateway to the superheroes. That totally makes sense because a lot of people actually say that when Ditko left and Romita came in, that they turned it into Archie, basically, right? With Peter Parker as Archie, and I think Mary Jane would be Veronica, and Gwen was like Betty, and then Harry Osborn was like Reggie, right? So this is interesting that that would be your gateway to superheroes. That makes total sense, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Romita, you know, Steve Ditko had this amazing, quirky, isolated style that, you know, Pete got a lot more handsome and, you know, all the characters became beautiful. And so, yeah, the through line from like Dan DiCarlo to John Romita was very close. You know, after that, I was hooked and I started buying stuff that was more current, like Eric Larson on Spider-Man, Jim Lee on the X-Men, some Batman stuff. And, you know, once you're in a comic shop, the floodgates open and you can start picking up back issues. And I was really into Justice League International and Daredevil and things like that. I became obsessed with Chris Claremont's X-Men. I started reading the classic X-Men as it kind of, you know, the cool thing about Marvel at the time is there was no real expansive book trade presence. You know, there were a few trades here and there. So a lot of publishers reprinted classic stories through monthly periodicals, like something that Archie still does today through the Digest. But so you had Classic X-Men, which reprinted from the beginning of Giant Size. And then you had Marvel Tales, which started reprinting classic Spider-Man stuff. So that was my education, kind of reading old back issues through reprints and then keeping up with the current issues. And I was a big Spider-Man guy. X-Men, Batman was my guy at DC. I did appreciate Superman, but I wasn't as into like the cosmic stories. I like the Avengers, but I was much more into the Outcasts and the Mutants and things like that. And then some indie stuff like Steve Rudes and Mike Barron's Nemesis.
Oh, yeah, Rockets. Great. We're close to the same age. So you're really saying like, I grew up on that stuff. Did that classic X-Men reprint? I mean, to me, that was awesome. I don't even think I knew they were reprints when I was picking them up from the store until I found out.
Yeah, I didn't understand. I didn't understand until my dad, we went out to lunch. He was like kind of my doorway to comics. We would buy comics together. When I'd go over to his house on the weekend, he'd take me to the shop or to the newsstand and we'd pick up a few books. Also, he had been a comics reader as a kid too. So he explained to me, he was like, no, those are comics that came out when I was a kid. Like you're reading the books I read as a kid. And that was, and I just loved it because I was getting this backstory that I didn't really have when I was reading the current stuff. That was so, you know, there were thousands of characters running through.
I think Mark Silvestri's X-Men was coming out at the same time as some of that classic X-Men. And I don't even think I even understood
what was going on
at the time. Yeah. Like I just knew I liked them a lot. Yeah.
And the X-Men seemed cooler. They were kind of outcasts and defiant. Yeah. And the Avengers were the all-stars, which was fine. But I was definitely into the outcasts like Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And Daredevil was always like, even though he had these great creative runs, was considered sometimes a B-lister. And I was reading like Ann Nesenti stuff. I remember being really drawn to Lee Weeks on Daredevil when he did that Last Right story with D.G. Chichester. That was great stuff. But yeah, it was like kind of comic DNA coming in. And I stayed a fan and I went to college. I started working in journalism. I was a reporting intern and an editor at different places. I think it was early on in college when I had just come off a reporting internship. And I was realizing that the internship was not going to become a job, that I reached out to Mike Duran at Newsarama, who is still the editor at Newsarama, and Matt Brady, who is not the editor, but, you know, was there for a very long time. Totally like a cold AOL instant message. I just messaged them. And that dates the conversation as well. But I messaged them and I was like, hey, I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter and an editor. And I am a huge comic book fan. And I'd love to like, I mean, I was, you know, like you, I wasn't just a fan of comics. I was a fan of the history of comics. So as a kid, you know, I would even do like my own like fantasy football style pairings. Like what if John Byrne drew Spider-Man? And this was before he did, but you know, things like that, when you're like kind of moving the pieces around to figure out what a great match would be. And I'd always read, you know, books about comics and the history of comics. And that was my first kind of comic book gig, interviewing creators. I interviewed Peter David about Young Justice.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And it was email, the early days of email interviews. So, and Ed Brubaker was one of my first interviews for Point Blank, which was kind of the book that set up Sleeper in the Wildstorm universe. You know, they were giving me a lot of the kind of entry interviews, like, let's see this kid do it. And I stuck around for a couple of years, and eventually I saw Wizard Magazine had an opening for an associate editor. And I grew up on Wizard. I didn't have a ton of money as a kid of my own. So if I only had like $5 or $6, I would buy Wizard because then I'd at least know what was going on in comics and read the interviews. And that was really my gateway to behind the curtain, as opposed to just reading the comics and enjoying the stories. I got to meet the creators and kind of get a sense of their personalities, which was right around the time of the Image Revolution, which was so exciting. And Valiant was huge at the time. And DC and Marvel were doing Death Superman and, you know, Nightfall and Heroes Reborn a few years later. So it was a very intense and epic time to be a comic reader.
Yeah, there was definitely like a cultural climax of the 90s that almost seemed to signal like the end of the old way. But you had to be there to feel that.
Yeah, it was really a seismic moment in comics, I think. And there was also like business news, like Marvel buying Heroes World and, you know, companies being born or, you know, Marvel buying Malibu. I remember that was a huge story. These stories that are now kind of not footnotes, but like only referenced by insiders. But it was an interesting time to watch the industry grow and contract and then grow again. And so I reached out to Wizard. I applied. I spoke to Joe Iannarella, who is now at Bleacher Report. He's like a big wig at Bleacher Report. And I flew up to Congers, New York, which I thought, oh, I'm going to the big city. And, you know, Rockland County, New York is suburban. It's suburbia. It's not Manhattan by any stretch, but it was my first exposure to snow and the Northeast. And I got the job, which was amazing. And I was there for a couple of years, and that was really a crash course in working in comics full time. So I went to conventions. I got to meet I got to put faces to names, like people I would email or talk to on the phone. I became, you know, I got to connect with in person, which was really exciting. And then after that, I moved back to
Miami. What year was that? Just so we're all on the same page.
Early 2000s. So I think 2002, 2003. And then and then after that, I moved back to Miami and worked at the Miami Herald again. And I started reviewing graphic novels for the newspaper, in addition to like just my job as an editor and working on the website. And that was fun because I got a ton of free books. I got to review a bunch of cool stuff, like Gibbons' is the Originals and the Watchmen reissue and stuff like that, a lot of indie stuff. And I emailed my contact at DC, David Hyde, and I said, I'm going to be in town in New York on vacation. I'd love to just visit the offices and say hello. And, you know, I'd never gotten a tour of the DC New York offices. It just felt like a dream. And David said, sure, I'd love to see you. Would you want to apply for this job? And they had a job as a publicity manager at DC. And I said, okay. I hadn't even considered moving back to New York. I thought it was just going to be what it was going to be. And I was going to be in Miami. And that would be, not to sound resigned, I just didn't think I'd come back to New York quickly. And I ended up all these conversations happened as I was already on vacation in New York. So I had to kind of scramble and, you know, buy a suit and prep for an interview. And I spoke to David. I spoke to the marketing people. I got to sit with Paul Levitz for the first time and chat with him for the interview. And I got the gig. And then I was back in New York and I was working at DC doing publicity. And really, that was a great... I always knew I wanted to write. So I always knew I was going to eventually write my own stories, whether they were comics.
This was 2012. The official job title was Executive Director of Publicity, right?
Actually, I had two stints at DC. The first one was Publicity Manager, and it started in 2006 to about 2009.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. So that's where that started. Okay.
It was a great opportunity as a publicist, well, as a journalist to shift over to publicity and learn how to be a publicist, but also as someone who wanted to write and write stories to just see how it was done and just soak up what these people were doing. Like people like Brad Meltzer, who I'd met when I was at Wizard, but I got to meet him and kind of see how he worked, you know, Scott Snyder, Gail Simone, Greg Rucka, you know, so many huge, huge talents, and just seeing not only how they behaved as professionals, but also the work. You get to read scripts, you get to see the process. And I was probably the publicist that just loved hanging out in the editorial offices, just hearing what was coming up, sitting in different editors' offices and seeing what they had tacked onto the wall. So
then as publicity manager, so then what would you do with that information?
You'd figure out a way to promote it. You'd figure out the timeline, like, you know, where do we announce this? Where do we show preview art? You know, you create a timeline for announcing the work and promoting the work. And this was an era where Wizard was still around, but kind of not as powerful as Wizard had been. You know, they weren't the tastemaker. And I think the challenge there was because Wizard had a web presence, but their web presence never really like broke out timed. You know, you had Newsarama, you had Comic Book Resources, you had a bunch of other online outlets that, and I was partially guilty of this. You know, when I left Wizard and I came back, I did some freelancing for Newsarama, and I'd get my subscriber copy of Wizard, and then I'd run to Newsarama and we'd post the story, like saying, hey, Wizard is reporting so-and-so. So the exclusivity, you know, when you're a print magazine, your exclusivity is only as long as somebody looking at it and retyping the story. So, you know, we'd credit Wizard, but they no longer, I guess, had that same power. And I'm not taking credit for that alone. I was one of many reporters doing that. So anyway, so as a publicist, you had to pitch around the story. You dealt with the comic trade. I was mainly the comic book trade person. So I would interact with Newsrama and Wizard and CBR and all those places. And that was a lot of fun because I came in the comic book trade. So it felt like I was really just chatting with the people that I was contemporaries with. I got to hang out and talk to the creators, but also see what the editors were doing. You know, people like Steve Wacker and Pete Tomasi and Joan Hilty and Mike Martz and, you know, and Dan DiDio had just set up shop there at DC as the head of, you know, the editorial, and also a lot of the Vertigo editors like Karen Berger, Shelley Mond, Will Dennis. So it was an education every day, just kind of seeing. My eyes were like starry-eyed most of the time, but I tried to kind of keep it together. But it was a great education, and it was a really cool experience.
And that's an interesting time because there's a lot of like the like older people in comics and then newer people coming in. So you're kind of at that in-between point where you're like interacting with like two different generations of creators, it sounds like.
Yeah, you got to see a new wave of talent, like people that are huge names now were starting out then, especially through Vertigo. Like you had Jason Aaron do something. He did The Other Side at Vertigo, and that was his big, you know, launch. And then he did Scalped, and then he started to really get some heat. Or Scott Snyder, who started with American Vampire and then, you know, took over Batman and became huge. G. Willow Wilson did a book called Cairo and then Air, maybe not in that order, but then she, you know, she went on to do amazing things. So yeah, it was interesting because you had the old guard and you had some up and comers coming in and really establishing themselves. It was just fun to see, to be part of kind of the publishing machinery. But at the same time, I had just moved to New York. So it was a whole different world, a whole different experience for me coming from Miami. And comics was now my day job. So, you know, not just writing about comics or being a fan of comics, but like the Mac machinery of comics. So I'd get a stack of the DC releases every week, which is amazing. It was amazing. And I was like, wow, this is heaven. Like I'm getting free comics like every week, but it was your job. Like I had to read them. I had to see what are the publicity hooks here. Like, what's important? What did we miss? Like what made it through to the comics that we weren't able to maximize in the press? And so I started thinking about other things creatively, and I was reading a lot of noir novels. Like I'd always liked true crime. I'd always liked crime novels as a kid. I read The Godfather probably too young an age, the novel, which is really pulpy and dark, and a lot of like Sherlock Holmes and stuff like that. So I always loved mysteries, but
yeah.
I got turned on to a lot of newer crime, or, you know, other icons like Jim Thompson and Patricia Highsmith and Ross McDonald, and then more current writers like Dwayne Straczynski and Laura Lippman and Megan Abbott.
You were going back. You were exploring the genre on a literary level, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was really going to like, it was like a buffet table. I was getting a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But
Did you like Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and all that stuff too?
Yeah, I was more of a Chandler was the sweet spot. It was just like, you know, he set the tone for PI fiction forever. Like whenever you write a PI novel, you owe some debt to Raymond Chandler, whether you're flipping what he did or you're just honoring what he did. But a lot of the mysteries I was reading were really steeped in setting. So, you know, you read a Baltimore novel a Boston novel by Dennis Lehane, and you felt like you were touring the seedier sides of Boston, or Baltimore by Laura Lippman, or Washington East by George Pelicanos. And I think I was really homesick at the time. You know, New York is amazing. You're full of people. There's people everywhere. You're surrounded all the time, but it can be a little lonely, you know, especially if you're coming from a different place and it just feels you're isolated. So I started to get really homesick, and I thought, well, what if I just for fun started writing my own PI novel? And I created this character, Pete Fernandez, who, was like me, Cuban American, and had similar background.
And what year did you like conceive of Peter Fernandez?
You know, it's funny because the first edition of the book came out in 2013, and by then I had left DC, gone to Archie, and come back to DC. But I was thinking about the Pete novels long before then. You know, I was thinking about it towards the end of my time at the first time at DC, and I was pecking away at this book and thinking about it. And I had a draft. And I remember sharing it with John Cunningham, who was the SVP of sales or the VP of sales and marketing then. And I had never really shown it to anyone. And I printed it out at the work computer. And I was like, here, you know, just rip it apart. If it's terrible, don't tell me. And he read it. And he was like, you know, those first few pages got me hooked. And that's the first victory. And I think people don't really recognize those early reviews or those early notes of encouragement. Like, writers don't forget that, because it's do or die at that point. Like you're so so fragile at that point that you don't even think about, like, if someone says, oh, this is terrible, it just could sink your momentum and you just say, well, it's not for me.
Even as an interviewer, that's true. I think the Neil Adams and Jim Steranko, when I interviewed them, and they just kept, they complimented me a lot after, like, you really did this right. Now, that totally, without that, I don't know if I would have even continued, you know?
Yeah. It might kill your momentum. And so at the time, I was still writing the first draft, and I moved from DC to Archie. And at Archie, I oversaw all publicity efforts as opposed to being just part of the pub.
That was 2009 when this happened.
Yeah. But I did get my first comic book credit came at DC. I wrote a short story for a Halloween special that Mike Martz was editing, which I really owe him because at the time it was kind of frowned upon for DC staff to write at DC, which for good reason. I mean, at Marvel, remember Marvel in the 90s when editors were writing all the comics and it became this issue. But Mike knew that I wanted to write. And so it was a throwaway Flash and Frankenstein story, but it was a lot of fun. And it got me kind of thinking about the conventions of comics and the structure of a script and things like that. And that was my first credit. And then when I got to Archie, I was obviously doing publicity, but I had made it known that I wanted to write. And Mike Pellerito, who was the president then, threw me a few classic art stories. So I wrote one where they went to a comic convention. I wrote one where Archie had like four dates on the same night. And that kind of opened the door to Archie Meets Kiss, which was my first like big project. Our CEO, John Goldwater, said, you know, Gene Simmons wants to do an Archie crossover. And then I don't know what possessed me in the moment, but I said, I'd love to write it. You know, I knew of Kiss and I obviously listened to the greatest hits, but I was by no means a Kiss obsessive.
Cause that's kind of before our generation, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was more like, I mean, I love the Beatles. I love like 70s music, but for whatever reason, Kiss was a little bit of a blind spot, but I knew enough to be able to write a story about them. And with Archie Meets Kiss, we brought in Francesco Francavilla to do the covers. And I think that helped, you know, recalibrate how people looked at the character. Yeah. So it wasn't just like this classic style. He could be interpreted in different ways. And that was a big game changer. And around the same time, a few years after that, I moved back to DC. And that's when Silent City was ready to come out. And then it came out from a very, very small publisher, Codorus Press. And it was like, you know, a boutique publisher. And eventually got picked up by Polis Books, and they reprinted Silent City and then published the rest of the Pete series.
Yeah. And then just so people don't know, the Silent City is the first of the Peter Fernandez series. There's five of them from what I understand. And then there's, they got their Anthony Award nominated series, Silent City, Down the Darkest Street, Danger Sends, Blackout, and Miami Midnight. And I love the covers. I love the neon of the covers.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's just so much fun. But that being said, you touched upon it, is you have a long history of implementing music into comics. And what's interesting about that is that's not easy to do, to converge an auditory medium into a visual medium like comic books. But all the samples I've seen, which we'll talk about some also, you know, like Archie Meets the Ramones and the Archies, and there's something about the way those are presented that I feel like I'm feeling the music as I'm reading those. How did music make its way in? And I noticed that with Secret Identity, there's references to the Velvet Underground, things like that. So how did music kind of get involved in what you do?
Yeah, I mean, music's always been a passion of mine. I was in bands in college and early on when I first moved to New York.
So you're in a band. Okay, there you go.
I was, yeah, not anymore. I don't have time. I mean, I wish I still kind of, I can mess around on the guitar and be okay, but I barely have time for that. But it's just one of those things you give up. Yeah, music's always been a big part of it. And when Matt Rosenberg and I were writing Ramones and we were writing B-52s and things like that, he's a music guy too. So we would always think about it. How do we evoke the feeling of listening to music through comics, which is so hard because there's no audio element to it. It's not like you can play some chords, but I think we knew enough about the lingo of being in bands and touring and things like that, that we tried to give it this sense of authenticity. Like the Archie's book drawn by Joe Eisma, and it was an ongoing series. That was my first ongoing book. We had cameos each issue, but we needed to have one overarching story. So it was like the story of the Archies on tour. And they met all these bands like Churches and Tegan and Sarah. They had a dream sequence where they met the Monkees. Blondie in the modern day.
Yeah. I love that. And I love how the art kind of changed on the one that takes place in the 60s. So well done. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Joe was great. He's like so underrated. I think he deserves all the praise. He was able to draw it in a classic style to, you know, Archie gets bonked on the head by a guitar. Yeah, and then he has this dream sequence where he's playing with the monkeys. And then Joe did it in the classic style. And then R2 wakes up and you know, there's a knowing wink at the end. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. And yeah, really, we wanted to write a story about friendship. And, you know, it sounds depressing, but about failure. You know, sometimes you don't succeed, but you still, you know, it's about the journey and the friends you make on the way and the personal relationships. And so that was the big thing. And I was bummed that the series ended, but, you know, sales numbers dictate what things do, you know, what continues. Yeah.
I love pop culture references, pop culture history. So it spoke to me when I was, when I read it. So,
oh, good.
Now you're also like the dark, an editor of the Dark Circle series of comic books at Archie. So you were editing like the Black Hood in 2015. Can you tell us about that? Because you also edited some work by like Mark Waid. How is it like kind of editing, you know, these creators? And tell us about that stint with Archie with the Dark Circle titles.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, when I came back, I was at DC for a couple of years after my first stint at Archie. And then DC decided to move to Burbank and I couldn't make that move. So I started talking to Archie and they said, you know, we'd love to have you run our PR department. And I asked if I could also do some editing because that was something I was interested in. And they said that they wanted to relaunch their superheroes and that was really it. And so I was intrigued by that. They'd done some stuff. They did the first Fox miniseries by Mark Waid and Dean Haspiel. And I came in with a pitch and my idea was to really treat it more like a network as opposed to a big overarching continuity that you needed to really understand to get any of the books. And so I treated it more as like a genre exercise. So the Black Hood, which was Dwayne Straczynski and Michael Gatos, who obviously, you know, co-created Jessica Jones, that was our crime book. And The Shield by Chuck Wendig and Adam Christopher and Drew Johnson was your espionage spy book. And something like The Hangman by Frank Thierry and Felix Ruiz was the horror book. And so on. And we didn't get past that. You know, we had that first wave of titles. We had The Fox also, which was the second arc of the Waid Haspiel book. And that was much more like superhero hijinks and comedy and adventure. It was great. I mean, I learned on the job, which was challenging. But, you know, Paul Kaminsky, who's now a group editor at DC, was extremely helpful in giving advice and helping me like kind of learn the ropes. And I credit him with showing me just how the mechanics of editing editorial as opposed to, you know, the style. But you know, that was interesting. It was really, you know, the passion for those characters is so strong, but I think the response was pretty good to those iterations, and it didn't take anything away from what you'd read before. So, you know, there was previous Black Hoods, but the new Black Hood was a different person and the new Shield was a different person. So it's interesting to see those characters kind of live on in their own way. But it was a learning experience, and it was pretty invaluable, I think.
And there's also a history that a lot of companies do where just to kind of renew their trademarks, they use it. They might be totally different secret identities of those characters, you know, like the Vision at Marvel there's another Vision before. So this kind of sounds like an exercise of that in a sense too, but in a good creative way that's awesome. And it sounds like you really kind of cut your teeth on even further on the creative aspects of comics rather than the public relations of the company. So that's great. And that sounds like then that leads into a lot of more comics as far as editing and writing. And so I want to kind of ask you about the Archies because we mentioned it, but was there any supposed synergy of any kind between that and the Riverdale show? Was there ever intended anything like that? Or were there any things you had to stay conscious of?
Not so much. I think, you know, the benefit, I think, of being at a smaller company was we were always in contact. You know, Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, who is the showrunner of Riverdale, is the chief creative officer of Archie. So he had a direct line to the company. And if any, you know, there was good communication. So it was more like, how do we capitalize off this awareness and remind people of the connective tissue so that people that are watching Riverdale realize, oh, this is Archie, the comic book. And then they go to the comic book and kind of engage with that. So it was much more about like, how do we help each other as opposed to like, we can't do this because it's on the show.
Right,
like,
there you go.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it was also like, I think at that point, which was a testament to the flexibility of the character, people understood that this was an iteration of Archie as opposed to like, you know, the only version. And so people were flexible with how the character was interpreted, which was cool.
Yeah. And I noticed that seems to be a theme at Archie, the company, that there can be different interpretations of these characters. They don't all have to be in the same continuity and think of it as a multiverse. And this is Archie meets zombies, or, you know, Archie meets Punisher. It's a fun exercise because I think those characters are so almost elemental now to pop culture that you can do stuff like that and consumers will just have fun with it. I think that's a real unique kind of thing. Whereas I think in superheroes, people get upset. They're like, that's not how it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, and that doesn't count. And there's never really been continuity at Archie. Like, there's consistency. Like, Jughead likes to eat burgers. And if you change that, you're probably changing his intrinsic characteristics. Or Veronica is rich. And if you change that, it might not be Veronica. Yeah. Unless you do it in a way that gets her back to her status quo. So there's consistency, but there's no continuity. And so I think when, you know, I think when John Goldwater took over the company, there was a sense that Archie as an IP was heading into the space of like Popeye or Betty Boop, which is not a bad space, but more like a retro nostalgia brand. And he really stemmed that tide and pivoted and made it a much more fluid brand and something that could change and adapt for the times, which is amazing. Like, now you see so many different iterations of the characters, which is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I was watching that first Riverdale episode and him and his teacher were in that car. And I was like, wow, this is not the same Archie. Yeah, yeah. I'm intrigued. I want to see more.
Yeah, exactly.
So now, and I see this a lot, you know, because I've researched your other interviews. You were co-president of Archie Comics in 2017. I think from what I understand, you oversaw the company's editorial and communications. What is a co-president? How does that work?
Yeah. I mean, it's the title in itself doesn't define itself. You know, when you say like SVP of sales and marketing, you kind of know what the job entails, but co-president was a way of saying like a little bit of everything. Like, you know, I touch new biz, like new biz development, like partnerships, editorial oversight of the new stuff, but it was all done in a team setting. So, you know, obviously John decided the big picture stuff as the CEO, and Mike Pellerito, the other president, had a big say in things. So it was such a small shop that, and it continues to be a very tight knit group, that a lot of stuff was just done together, which was great. It was a nice way to work.
It sounds like co-publisher. Would that also be a way to describe that?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. It's really just, you know, having a voice in the room, which is important, and, you know, just growing the brand and trying to make, you know, whether it's a business thing or a creative thing, like having input on those decisions. And it was a blast. I mean, I grew up on those characters, so to have had any influence on what happened with them is an honor.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. So then, and you also edited titles like Archie Meets Batman 1966. Those Mike Allred covers are awesome. Dan Parent's art, awesome. You edited Archie, Katie Keene, Betty and Veronica. Now, with these different titles, although they're all Archie characters or Archie style characters, when you edit, do you have to keep like target demographics in mind? And are they different between those books?
Yeah, they vary. I mean, I think the big shift is when you're doing like classic Archie, you're obviously doing something that's family friendly and for all ages. You have to keep that in mind. Whereas you're doing something, the shorthand we used was New Riverdale, but that was, you know, we phased that out. But the idea is like Archie stories that evoked Riverdale that actually predated Riverdale, like the Mark Waid, Fiona Staples, Archie stuff was in many ways what spurred people to understand Riverdale and came out first. But in that world, the shorthand we used was New Riverdale, but that's a little bit more YA leaning. It never veers into adult. But then you have stuff like Dark Circle, which was much more like our HBO content. Like there was, you know, some adult language, the violence was more intense, but it was also a different imprint. So we were okay with that. So yeah, you always have to kind of know what your audience is, and you obviously want to hopefully expand your audience, but we tried to keep those things in mind.
A little more on Peter Fernandez, and then we kind of go to kind of off comics into your writing in other media. Some of the themes in like your part three, Peter Fernandez, first it's about an ex-newspaper man. So you're an ex-newspaper man, right?
Yeah.
Cuban also, right? I mean, Peter Fernandez. And but then he turns into a PI. He wants to redeem himself, you know, by helping people. He's alcoholic, you know, he's got baggage. So there's a bit of a redemption arc to the character, which I find interesting. But it's also some of the themes. Like, I think part three, there was pro Castro killers mentioned in it, right? So living, as you said, in exile, as a Cuban exile, what is your feeling toward Fidel Castro? And how did that your depiction of those pro Castro killers in part three of Peter Fernandez?
I should zoom out and say that each of those books is whatever I was obsessing over at the time. Like I never wanted the series to feel just episodic where the character doesn't change. I wanted the Pete that you met at the beginning of whatever book to be very different from the Pete at the end. So at the end of, you know, the book's been out for a while, so I won't spoil it too much, but at the end of Dangerous Ends, he's on the run, you know, stuff has happened. In terms of the Castro stuff, I'd read a lot of books about Cuba and the Cuba Miami dynamic and the opposition between Cuba's government and the Cuban exile community. And it's all things are complicated. Nothing is ever black and white. And obviously, you know, so I wanted to show some of that, but obviously also note that, you know, Castro was not a good guy, and what he did was not a good thing. And you know, whether he did it under the auspices of being a revolutionary, and I'm sure he has supporters like any authoritarian has, but that doesn't mean that you're right, you know, just because you have some people behind you. So I wanted to show some of that historical texture in that book. I wanted to show that Pete's background, you know, touched on things that went deeper. The roots went deeper and went back to Cuba. And I wanted to show that and not make it a typical PI novel. So I had flashbacks to Pete's grandfather in Cuba, escaping Cuba during the takeover. I had flashbacks to Pete's dad, who is a presence throughout the series, even though he's never alive in the series. Like from page one, he's passed away.
And that was a great answer. And I appreciate that.
Oh, thanks.
Part four, it was about like a cult leader, just really fun things that are kind of spooky that you bring up in the Pete Fernandez series. And it's cool that there's the dynamic and the variety of them. In 2018, you co-created and co-wrote the Lethal Lit podcast, 6 episodes for iHeartRadio about Tig Torres, a woman dealing with a lit killer in the city of Hollow Falls. And the murders were based on classic literature. Tell us about that experience and how it sounds like it'd be different writing for a podcast. Is that right? It's a different medium.
Yeah, it's totally different. And there was a learning curve there. I mean, I'd written scripts, obviously, for comics, but comics are a visual medium. So you're writing to the artist and you're deferring to the artist to create the imagery. With audio, you can't show anything visually. It's obviously audio. So even the cues have to be audio based. So when someone enters the room, you have to make a note like sound effects, door creaking. And then the conversation has to be a little bit perfunctory. You have to say, "Hey, Alex, how are you?" "I'm fine, Bill." You know, like you have to kind of explain, you know, like
it's like writing for radio, right?
I mean, yeah, you're writing for radio, basically. And that's just like kind of the nuts and bolts of it. But I was also, that was one of the first times I was writing pure YA. It's YA podcast. Whereas, you know, the Archie stuff was YA, but not defined as YA. And so
what's YA?
Young adult. And the idea being like, you're kind of experiencing a character's coming of age in some ways, not necessarily, you know, whether it be professionally or personally or some kind of moment of truth. And, you know, the emotions are ramped up because you have a younger cast. And when we're younger, we're, I guess, much more not as jaded as we are now. But I really looked back at shows that I had a fondness for that, you know, kind of touched on that high school mentality, mainly stuff like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like this idea of a little bit of the Scooby-Doo stuff. Like, you know, you have this crew of young teenagers trying to do what the adults couldn't accomplish. And so I got to co-write the series with Monica Gallagher, who I went on to co-create The Black Ghost with. And that was a lot of fun because Monica has a great knack for dialogue and character quirks. And I'm much more of a plotter and just like, you know, the mystery person. So I wanted to make sure that the big reveal at the end caught everyone off guard. And, you know, you had enough red herrings and you had enough clues. And
yeah,
a lot of the fun was like digging up clues from literature and like dropping those into the story, like, yeah, Dracula or the Crucible or things like that. Like I went back to my own like English lit roots as a kid in high school. Like, what were the books we had to read in high school? And that was a lot of fun because I got to revisit some of the classics and some of the books that I were defining to me as a writer. But,
you know, people had to read them in school. If that many more people then could relate to the podcast as well.
Yeah, I think there was an awareness for those books because they were part of the curriculum, I think, across the country, like especially for people our age, like the books we had to read and that were perpetually like continue to be read by high schoolers. So that, I think, was the touchstone for a lot of stuff. And it was a lot of fun. The response was great. And I think there's a point in audio writing where you kind of hand it off. We handed it off to the showrunner, this guy, J.B. Blanc, who is also an actor. And it was just so interesting because as a novelist, you control everything. As a comic book writer, you're basically the screenwriter and the director is the artist. So you kind of hand the script off and hope that they, yes, you know, kind of adapt what you do and add to it. And in audio, it's very similar. You're handing it off to the recording engineer or the director, and he or she manages that part of it. And we got to be in the room. We got to see a table read, which was wild to see actors reading your script and then watch them record their parts. And listening to the final product was really, it was just a treat. It was just like a unique experience for me.
Yeah, that's fun. And you would actually write the sound effect in the script. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. Well, you would note it.
And then the producer would do whatever with that. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, in comics, you have to specify like literally thoom or crack or, yes, you know, whereas in audio, you just note, okay, SFX door opening or SFX hand slamming onto table. Like, and they can always tinker with that and do what they want, but at least you're kind of giving them a guide. And it's interesting because the audiobook of Secret Identity has those comic book sequences, but they're done in an almost audio drama way. It was just really neat. We can get to that, I guess, when we touch on that.
But. Yeah, which I'm excited to talk about because I noticed the red herring, and I'm not going to say what it is, in Secret Identity, that I was actually myself going up the red herring tree for a while.
Yeah.
Now, in 2018, you wrote a story in Where We Live by Image Comics about the eyewitness account of Layla Tyree about the Las Vegas shooting. Tell us first how that shooting affected you and how you got involved in writing that short story.
Yeah, I mean, gun violence is such a prevalent problem in our country. It's just, it's insane, and it's costing so many lives. It continues to be a problem. And, you know, we've moved far beyond thoughts and, you know, quote unquote thoughts, and not to get too political, but quote unquote thoughts and prayers solving anything. I mean, we need some like serious legislation. So, you know, what happened in Vegas was catastrophic, even in comparison to other mass shootings, not to compare and contrast, but it was just like such a terrible situation. And then J.H. Williams, the amazing artist, and was editing this book with Will Dennis, who I knew from my days at DC. And they reached out and said, we have some eyewitness stories. We'd love a writer who has like a journalistic background to talk to these people or at least read their stories and put them into comic book form. And so I got to work with Marco Finnegan, who's a great artist, and do one of those. I did two of them, and it was just it's so intense to read these stories of people like literally running for their lives or watching people be gunned down. It was so heart-wrenching, and I felt it was a huge responsibility to have to craft those stories and then relay them and do justice to their stories, but also have a message and a theme. It was hard. And it's hard to be succinct in any medium. It's hard to, like, you know, with a novel, you can write it as long as you want. With a short story, it's much harder. You have a couple thousand words to create a vignette. Like, by vignette, I mean an emotional response as opposed to like a three-act structure. And so, you know, it was a challenge, and it was such an all-star crew of creators in that book. So it was really an honor to be part of it. And that was the first time anything I'd written was in an Image publication. So that was cool to see as well.
2019, this was a fun one. I enjoyed flipping through it. This was the Black Ghost for New Wave Comics, 2019. It's about reporter Laura Dominguez, also from Miami, investigating, becoming the vigilante, the Black Ghost. So there's definitely a theme of, you know, these Miami-based investigators, you know, kind of transplanted into a new place, but in this case becoming a vigilante and almost like the Lethal Links in a sense. So can you tell us first about writing in the perspective of a female vigilante or female investigator? I know that you share roots as far as the Cuban heritage, being from Miami, being able to speak from that perspective, but how do you then also go into another gender? And tell us about that in context of writing The Black Ghost or co-writing The Black Ghost.
Yeah, The Black Ghost sprung out of Lethal Lit in many ways. You know, Monica Gallagher and I became fast friends, and our collaboration was so painless. And that's really hard to find collaborators that you not only, you know, you like them as people, but you also enjoy working together, and you feel like the final product, the union of your work, is greater than you could have done by yourself. And so I think working with Monica is that kind of collaboration where she adds so much and I add so much, and the final thing is greater than the sum of its parts. And so we went back and forth. We finished Lethal Lit, and I said, do you want to work on a comic stuff? Because Monica is a comic book writer and artist. She's done so many amazing things for different places. And we came up with this idea, The Black Ghost, and we wanted to, in the same way that Pete Fernandez books honors the PI genre, but also flips the script on a lot of stuff. You know, Pete, like many private eyes, is a hard drinker, but he's also kind of in recovery, and he's dealing with that in a way that I didn't see a lot of other PIs do it. And we kind of flipped a few of the tropes. I wanted to reapproach the idea of the street level kind of crime fighter, especially the legacy aspect of it. Like, a lot of times you see, not to, you know, criticize anyone, but I wanted to really look at it in a closer way. Like, what pushes someone to take on this costume and decide to become a superhero? And I'm pretty proud of the twist at the end of the first issue, because you go into the first issue, you think it's a story about a reporter chasing the hero. You don't assume that the reporter is going to then become the hero. So it's about Laura Dominguez, who's this obsessive journalist with her own personal problems in the city of Creighton, which was our love letter to kind of Gotham City and Hub City and places like that. And so in terms of writing outside of my experience, since, you know, I'm a straight man and Laura Dominguez is a woman, you know, obviously Monica was a great resource. You know, she could speak to a lot of things that I didn't know. And we kept a great, you know, dialogue going there. So I think that was the main thing there. And she had
it sounds like she kind of helped provide, insight into things that you may not have considered on your own.
Totally. Yeah. And so the idea there was to really catch people off guard by the end of the first issue. And so you read the first issue, you think it's going to be about Laura chasing around this vigilante, this great vigilante, and then he dies at the end and of the first issue. And that first arc is about her journey deciding to become the next Black Ghost. And that was kind of a little nod to the DC heroes I loved as a kid, like the legacy heroes, like Our Man and things like that, where there's another iteration of the hero in a generational story. And so that was a lot of fun. And really writing a vigilante crime fighter story as crime fiction, kind of blending my favorite stuff about crime fiction with superhero stories. And I really leaned into stuff like The Question, the Danny O'Neill run, Miss Tree by Max Collins and Terry Beatty, and things like that.
So it sounds like you, whenever you explore a genre in a specific medium, you check out previous works in that to see about style and things. That tunes you in more in that sense to like comic history moments as well, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I try to immerse myself in what's happening in that space. If I'm going to be part of that space or add to it, I always want to be, I want to be additive. I don't want to just do something that's been done before. Like I wanted to definitely evoke crime fiction and superhero crime fighters in a different way. Like I'm not saying it's totally like groundbreaking, but it was something that felt new to me. And look, at the end of the day, and I think this is a truism of any kind of creative stuff, is that you have to write the story that only you can write, but that you want to read, you know, that you're obsessed with. So
yeah, that's true. That way it's actually fun also to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now this is a whole different kind of direction, but Poe Dameron Freefall 2020, you wrote the origin of Poe Dameron in a Star Wars novel. He was partially orphaned, seeking adventure with the Spice Runners. How'd that come about with Lucasfilm? And how were those discussions? Were you given an outline of what technical things they just needed to have in there? How did that all happen?
Yeah, the Poe Dameron book, it's funny. I got an email from Lucasfilm and it was very general. It was, you know, would you ever want to do something with Star Wars? And that, you know, for someone like me who wears a ton of hats, it could have meant anything like editing, writing, publicity. And so I just said, yes. I said, whatever, you know, whatever you guys want. And then it became, as we drilled down, they explained that they wanted to do Poe's origin story, a YA novel set between Return of the Jedi and the first of the new trilogy. And they wanted it to basically be the connective tissue between Rise of Skywalker and Poe's origin story, kind of setting up a lot of the things that you'd see in the film. And so I was never like a traditional outliner with my novels. I would outline a little bit and write and outline again. And it was not an ideal process. It made rewriting intense. But when you're doing work for hire stuff, you have to present the outline. So we talked we had a conference call, which was great, and kind of brainstormed. And really what I wanted to do was write a crime novel in space. I wanted it to feel like a gritty noir adventure, obviously a YA adventure, but in space, in the world of Star Wars, and really explore what the underworld was like in the Star Wars universe, which to me was one of the most interesting parts of Star Wars. And they were cool with that. And so I outlined it in detail, about a 10 to 15 page outline where I literally broke it out by chapter. And I was really pleasantly surprised by how much creative leeway I had. You know, you never know going in dealing with someone else's IP, how much wiggle room you're going to have. But they really wanted unique voices. They wanted those unique voices to create characters and add to the mythos as opposed to just like play the greatest hits, which was refreshing for me. So, you know, a lot of those characters were things that were created in the novel, like the Spice Runners that Poe gets pulled away from. And to me, it's not just about Poe, it's about Zori Bliss, who you see for maybe 5 minutes in the movie, played by Carrie Russell. And she's this mysterious masked figure, a lot like Boba Fett was in the original trilogy, like such visually so cool and obviously important. But this book also gave you the weight and the reason why she was so important, like the backstory with Poe, what the relationship was like. And I like that it subverted and wasn't just a romance. It was about a friendship that sometimes became romantic, but wasn't just purely like a spurned lover, because I felt that was too easy. And for me, it was as much a Zori Bliss novel as it was a Poe Dameron novel. And it was a lot of fun to immerse myself in Star Wars. And it was such a nice like sea change from like the very gritty, like reality-based PI novels I was writing to doing something, you know, that was literally in another galaxy and dealing with different planets and spaceships. And because I'm a sci-fi kid too, I love Star Wars, I love Star Trek, I love, you know, I love science fiction. And so it was a lot of fun to kind of stretch those muscles. And I think the only drag was that it came out during the pandemic had just started when it came out. And I think the pandemic, you know, officially stuff started to shut down in March and then of 2020, and it came out that August. So I didn't really get to go to like Obviously, these are trivial problems compared to like the major issues happening.
But there wasn't the big tour of going to like a convention and talking to people about it. Yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah, but maybe someday. But it was a thrill. And it was really the author community of Star Wars authors was so welcoming and friendly and positive. And the fans were really great. And I think they appreciated the nuance that came from the book that, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, Poe is a spice runner. Like, there's a reason why he got swept away by the spice runners. It ties into his origin. It ties into his parents. And I just had a lot of fun creating those new characters, like the spice runners that he teams with, a lot of the villains. There was this, Asila Troon is this officer who's like, tasked with chasing down Poe, you know, and it was just cool. And I'm doing a short story for an upcoming anthology, a Star Wars anthology that doesn't play with any of those characters, but it's just fun to be in that and be able to kind of do stuff in that space now and again.
Two more questions. And then we're talking about Secret Identity.
All right.
So now 2020, you left Archie and you became a senior vice president at Oni Press. What led to that transition?
Yeah, so it was last May when I signed up with Oni. I think, you know, I had been with Archie about a decade on or off, and you know, all good relationships there. There was no acrimony or anything like that. It just felt like it was time to kind of try something else, and it was a good opportunity to be part of a publisher that has a great reputation with creators, a great reputation with in terms of the kind of books it publishes, and it's just a gear shift from doing traditional like IP based publishing to something where you're much more in conversation with the talent, where it's really, how do I help you as a creator actualize your vision for a book, as opposed to these are the characters and this is the assignment, please do that. And it's not that one is better than the other, but it was more, okay, let me try something else and see how this works for me, especially as my own creative career was kind of burgeoning and becoming bigger and more important. It just felt like the right move at the time. And it was nice to kind of refocus my day to day, as opposed, you know, at Archie, you get to wear 1,000 hats, which was fun. But here at Oni, it's like, I have a kind of a clearer path, I guess.
Now then, there is two short stories, more recent, more 2020, 2021, mm-hmm. Red Zone about Raul Alvarez and 90 Miles about Joaquin Carmona. Are those kind of like exercises in the genre as you're working on a bigger item? Tell us about those.
You know, in terms of short stories, I go when I'm like a vampire. If I'm invited, I will go, I will write a short story. I don't write them as part of my like creative journey. Yeah. Like I don't like sit back and say, oh, this will make a good short story, let me do that. It's if someone invites me and says, I'm doing this anthology, can you come up with something? I usually have a few ideas that are like percolating that aren't novels on their own. So Angel Colon, who is a crime writer and editor, was putting together an anthology called Pa' Que Tú Lo Sepas, which was to benefit Puerto Rico in the wake of Hurricane Maria. And it was pretty close to the deadline. And I had never written a noir story in sports. You know, I wanted to write a football noir about a kid in college, like a backup quarterback who's thrust into the role of starting quarterback. And the challenges he faces, not only as the guy stepping in for the hero, but also as a Cuban American kid in a predominantly white school. And so I wanted to do that, but also do it succinctly. It's a short story, so I couldn't really touch into a lot of the nuance of it. But I was blown away that it won the Anthony Award for Best Short Story. And the Anthonys are like the People's Choice Awards, basically, for crime fiction. And it's valuable because it's readers that are voting, as opposed to like a panel of judges. It's the readers who have actually read the story and liked it. And so that was a thrill. And 90 Miles was part of an anthology called Both Sides, edited by Gabino Iglesias, who's also a great crime writer. And the idea was to write a border noir story. And borders are, you know, they can be water, they can be land, they can be manufactured, or they can be spiritual borders. But yeah, I had never written just about, you know, the immigrant crisis from Cuba to Miami, the idea that so many people took this perilous journey and not as many survived, you know, many died in the waters, many died before they got off the island, many made it and thrived, which is fantastic. But I think a lot of people, you can get lost in the numbers, like kind of in the same way that a lot of people, you know, lose focus with the pandemic because they just see a number, but they're humans. Like, those numbers are people. And, you know, the people that didn't make it across the Florida Straits to the Keys from Cuba are real stories. And so I wanted to craft one story that evoked that. And, you know, it really resonated. It won the Anthony Award the next year. And it was also included in the Best American Mystery Stories of 2021, which was a huge honor.
It is. Now we're going to start talking about Secret Identity, but I want to bring up two pop culture Cuban figures in America, Desi Arnaz, mm-hmm. and the movie Scarface.
I mean, so, I love Lucy. Yeah. So,
yeah. So what's your impression of those two entities in pop culture?
I watched Scarface a lot as a kid, probably not ideal, but even as a kid, I was like, that does not look like the Miami I know, even the Miami of when I was younger. But I think it's an interesting movie. I love Brian De Palma. I think he has made some great films. I'm not going to rewatch it because I don't think it gets better every time I watch it. You know, it's just like Pacino is like chewing up the scenery. It's got some great performances. I think Michelle Pfeiffer is amazing in that movie. And, you know, Stephen Bauer, it's not the greatest crime film, but it's entertaining in its audacity. And I guess like how, you know, in your face it is, I can admire it for that, but it's definitely not on par with something like Goodfellas or The Godfather or that kind of like epic saga. Like it's a gangster movie. It's a fun gangster movie. Like you can't, if you take it too seriously, you're going to be disappointed. And Desi Arnaz is amazing. Like, you know, I grew up on I Love Lucy as a kid, just watching the black and white reruns. And it was just so cool to see, you know, my grandparents were like, oh, he's Cuban. And that was so amazing to see, like someone like us, like even back then was a force. And
Yeah, no, that's cool. He did a lot of production on that show too. So he was a bigger deal than I think a lot of people even knew, even though he already was a big deal. So let's talk about Secret Identity. It has released this month. So it's about Carmen Valdez. She's a writer from Miami who lives in New York, very much in a similar pattern as you also, being Cuban from Miami, living in New York and working in the publishing world. What I love is the scenery of the way you describe New York, but it's also New York of 1975. So tell us what went into that and at why 1975? Why did you write this story?
That's a great question. 1975 to me is a point in the comic book industry's history that is in stark contrast to today. You know, today, as you know, or as anyone listening probably knows, like comics are everywhere. Like the source material is what it is, but the awareness of comics is insanely high, or at least the awareness of the characters. So you have stuff like, you know, a Green Arrow TV show that's been running forever, or a Peacemaker TV show, or Ant-Man movie, or Guardians of the Galaxy, like IP that maybe when you and I were kids were interesting, but were not like front list or A-list characters.
It was more of a subculture back then.
Yeah, exactly. And so in 1975 too, you're not really in the full swing of the secondary market hasn't started. So you have maybe some comic shops, but they're not as prevalent. The secondary market and conventions aren't as big a thing. Like Phil Sewling is starting his shows. You're starting to see people buy and deal in back issues, but it hadn't become a part of the industry as a default setting. You know, like DC would later like create comics just for the direct market, you know, and Marvel would do the same, like, you know, Dazzler or New Titans.
And that stuff wasn't happening in 75.
It hadn't started in 75. And I don't think the editorial infrastructure was in place to kind of treat these characters as IP in the sense of, well, you can't do that to Spider-Man because he's going to be a movie, or you can't have that happen to Robin because we're going to have a TV show. You know, even though there had been a Batman show and there had been some stuff, it wasn't as prevalent or as, you know, as big a part. So I really wanted to show an industry that not only didn't have the same structure, but also was kind of at a low point in terms of success. Like the newsstand wasn't really thriving. I think you had stuff like the DC implosion or things that were, you know, like the newsstand, you have to print as having known the newsstand because of my time at Archie, like you have to overprint to sell a fraction, basically. You have
that's
to print,
right.
Like,
yeah. There's a print run and then there's a sell through rate, and that sell through rate determines the success of that print run. Yeah.
Yeah. And but then at the same time, so while the business itself might not be doing as well, and while maybe onlookers think, oh, well, comics are dying creatively, it's probably one of the more fertile times for traditional company-owned characters, because unlike now, they didn't have the option of going to Image or going to Oni or going to Dark Horse and creating their own IP and selling it and making it their own thing. So the creators had to pour themselves into these buckets, like these existing characters, and make them their own and really give them quirks and personality traits that were unique to the time. And it wasn't like editors would stop them because there was other stuff happening, other exploitation happening. It was pre-Shooter. So when Shooter came in at Marvel, he really laid down the law and kind of, you know, teed up the company to become what it became.
He's the one that made it IP aware, really.
Yeah, and the same thing was happening at DC, but I think there was this period in the mid-70s where it was a little bit like the Wild West in terms of what was happening with the characters. It was pretty trippy stuff. And I remember early on, before I started putting, I was in the research phase of the book. I got to, Sean Howe was very kind. Sean Howe, the author of Marvel, The Untold Story, very kindly gave me his time. And I said, you know, I was still trying to figure out when to set the book. I knew what the mystery was, but I was trying to figure out when to do it. And I said, it seems like you're really keen on the 70s. And he basically confirmed what I thought, that it was just such a, excuse me, such a vibrant period. And so...
And there's a certain darkness of it. Like there's a lot of shadows that people could hide in and still make comics.
Exactly.
And that's what's interesting about, and that's how the 80s was not that way. There was no shadow. There's a lot of oversight. I think in 75, I think it was like Marv Wolfman and Len Wein as editors in chief. And there was this whole thing with, I remember I talked to Marv Wolfman. He was like, we were just trying to like figure out. There were so many books at that point because of the new distribution through Curtis Circulation, way more books than what one editor in chief could really even look at every day.
Yeah, there was no, you know, Shooter always said, oh, I read every book. But I think back then there was just, not only were Marv and Len writing a ton of stuff, they had to manage the whole process. So you saw a lot of little fiefdoms, like writer editors, like who had control of their own little worlds.
And it was very unregulated and very, it was pure in a way, as far as a creator intent standpoint, but maybe not uniform as far as a corporate house style of writing styles.
Yeah, definitely. And also I was really curious about not only what was happening at Marvel and DC, but what was happening at these other publishers that were a little bit smaller that were trying to compete with Marvel and DC. Places like Atlas, Seaboard, you know, Harvey to some degree, obviously with the kids comics, you know, Charlton, Quality, the list goes on. And so I was really fascinated by the idea of setting the book not only in 1975, but not legally, I couldn't have set it at Marvel or DC. I guess I could have. It would have just taken a lot more nuance than I had the patience. Right. So I wanted to evoke the era, and I wanted to give the reader a sense of verisimilitude that, you know, if you, you know, you could imagine that this did happen in the same way that Chabon did it so well with Cavalier and Clay. Like, he weaves through history and you think, well, maybe there could have been the escapist and maybe, you know, Cavalier and Clay did exist. And those are my favorite kind of historical fiction books.
Did you read Hey Kids Comics, Howard Chaykin's stuff?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's, you know, and Bad Weekend by Brubaker and Phillips, which kind of.
Something I find in those is that there's always a character in that, in those books, they're always at least 51%. And that's how I kind of look at, there's at least 51%. A guy that they had in mind when they put that role down. And
You know, I get that question a lot. Like, oh, was there's an artist that Carmen works with that draws the first few length stories. Like, oh, was Doug Detmer like Jack Cole or Alex Toth?
You know who I imagined him as? I thought of him more as like a fusion character because, but he's definitely a fusion character as far as the way I saw it. But there's definitely like a Wally Wood alcoholism aspect to him that I really got, that I really connected with, because it reminded me a lot of the way Jim Shooter described his last interaction with Wally Wood in 1980 and how gaunt and awful and just self-destroyed he became. And I felt that with Detmer, but he sounded like a fusion character from what I was reading him.
I think if you want to do it right, you never want it to feel like, you don't want it to feel like comic book trivia where someone's just trying to figure out who they are. Like, you want to hit the archetype. Like, obviously the Detmer character is an archetype, but you also want to make him feel unique. You want to amalgamate the things you find interesting from history and research.
The guy that played the cyborg in Aliens, that's who I kept imagining Detmer looking like, that guy.
Oh, I could see that. Yeah. I cast him as kind of like Anthony Edwards from ER.
There you go. Yeah. Like an older kind of beat up version of that.
Yeah. Just kind of worn out. But a lot of the characters. So the big picture on Secret Identity, it tells the story of Carmen Valdez, who's a Cuban American woman who comes from Miami to New York to pursue her dream in 1975 of writing comics. And she gets a gig as a secretary to the publisher, editor in chief at this company called Triumph. And Triumph, like I said, is very much like a third rate comic publisher.
Triumph Comics, the editor, Carlyle.
Jeffrey Carlyle, And he's also another example of like an archetypical like company head in that era, but he's a little bit of Stan.
To me, he felt like a mixture of Chip Goodman and Stan Lee, like combined, is how I kind of kept thinking of him. Yeah.
Yeah, with a little bit of Jim Warren, I think.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but definitely not. And some new stuff, some other stuff that I added.
Right.
Obviously, because you want to make the characters your own. So she gets this job as a secretary to Carlyle, and she's pitching him stories. She's saying, Eli, I want to write this character. I want to do this. And he basically tells her, it's not going to happen. I have a line of freelancers out the door of my friends that I have to keep fed. And, you know, maybe someday you'll be an editor and someday you can run this place with me, but that's not what she wants. She wants to write comics.
And there was a certain sexism, maybe subconscious, that was present there. That whole glass ceiling, you know, it's funny. Some people say, you know, that it's not real, but it is actually real, especially from her perspective. She's Cuban and she's a female. So there's definitely a glass ceiling. Maybe it's subconscious from some of these people that you mentioned, but it was really interesting to almost be front and center to that conversation that you put in there.
Yeah, because he says it so blithely. He's just like, well, look, it's just not going to work out. Here's this other thing. And I think he clearly underestimates how passionate she is about this opportunity. Yeah. And so then she's approached by a colleague, Harvey Stern, who's about her a little younger than she is. He's a junior editor at Triumph, and he has sussed out that she wants to write comics because they're friends. And he basically says, you know, Carlisle's given me this assignment to launch a new female superhero. He hasn't told me anything else. I have to kind of do it whole cloth. Do you want to co-write it with me? But it has to be anonymous because, you know, let's see how it goes. And then eventually you'll get your credit. But for now, let's do it anonymously just to get it out the door because it's an insane deadline. And so, you know, they launched this character called the Legendary Lynx, drawn by Doug Dettmer, who, like we talked about, is this beloved but also complicated artist, like very.
Yeah. And he's burned a lot of bridges with publishers and has a bad temperament, but super talented. Everyone just loves the stuff he does. He's just hard to work with usually.
Right. Yeah. And so then he draws it. It becomes this huge hit. But at the same time, Harvey is murdered and Carmen finds him dead. And she's kind of painted into a corner. She can't tell Carlisle because he won't believe her, and B would be upset that she did this like behind his back, and she'd probably lose her job and any chance of like continuing to control the character because they turn in 6 scripts. The problem is all the scripts have Harvey's name and not Carmen's name. So no one has any idea that Carmen's written any part of this character. And so that's what kind of spurs her into being this amateur sleuth where she has to figure out A, who killed her friend, because as complicated as Harvey is, she still has some affection for him as a friend. And more, you know, and part of it too is like, how can she reclaim this character, the Lynx, that, you know, is so tied into her, like it's such a piece of her. Like there's a scene early on that I love when they're brainstorming the character and Harvey's kind of coming at it at zero. Like he's like, well, let's do this. And she busts out like a stack of notebooks and ideas. Like I've been waiting for this.
That she'd been writing her whole life, basically. Yeah.
Been building towards this moment my whole life. And now I've got it. So.
Even when Harvey did what he did, there was a certain sensitivity about the guy too that I felt
you feel bad for him.
That I felt was interesting. He wasn't just the straight up a-hole of the comic or of the story. He was he had a sense. There's a sense of inside that she felt aware of, even though she was not attracted to him on any physical level. She sensed that there was a certain damage in the guy, and that she almost kind of felt a certain empathy toward him. I thought that was interesting that two emotions of betrayal and empathy could exist in the same space, which is something that I think you had discussed a little bit of.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's, you know, look, it's in these kind of stories, you want to show the shades of gray. And so obviously she's mad, she's betrayed and frustrated that someone she trusted basically took credit for her work. And then, you know, he couldn't control that he was killed, but, you know, now she has no control over her ideas. And at the same time, she feels bad, not just because he's murdered, but because she knows he's got a complicated life. You know, he's opportunistic, but also caring. He's eager to climb the ladder, but he's also empathetic to her and her plight. And so, yeah, he's not a clear-cut villain. I don't think there is a clear-cut villain in the story. I mean, there's a bad guy and there's a murderer and there's a crime, but it's much more a character study, I think, than a pure, like, whodunit.
Yeah, right. Within the first couple chapters, that Jeffrey Carlisle wanted to one day write the great American novel. And I'm like, okay, I know that line.
I thought
that was just so cool because it really, it starts to already, people who know about that, it kind of pulls them in already. And then you start to really pay attention. Maynard.
Oh, yeah.
Maynard. I like that, the whole bad Jim Morrison impersonator comment. And then.
Cool vibes.
Yeah, yeah. And how he takes acid before writing his comics of Avatar. And, you know, it's funny because I'm just thinking of Jim Starlin's Warlock and things like that. You know, when I was reading that, I was like, yeah, I kind of feel that because I love that. I love the Starlin Warlock. You know, I love Starlin, all that. I think you and I like a lot of the same comics, but I definitely related to a lot of these characters from the get-go that I would pay attention whenever they were brought up, like, what's going on with Maynard these days?
Yeah, how's he doing?
What's up with Maynard, man? Let's get more Maynard in here.
Yeah, we need more Maynard. I wanted to create these fictional characters and people that would then make me want to read those comics. Like, I want to read Avatar now.
Yeah, I want to read Avatar. Yeah,
yeah, I want to see how, you know, it felt to me like a blend of like Warlock, but also a little bit of Omega the Unknown. Like,
yeah.
And you have to imagine that if you're working on one of those, like, comics at not just Marvel and DC, that you have even less editorial oversight. Like, so he was doing whatever the hell he wanted. He was like just dropping acid and then writing comic scripts and sending them in. And Carlisle is torn because he hates it as a taste. His taste is not that, but he also sees that it's their best selling title. So he can't like fire the guy. So he's also profit minded. So that was a lot of fun to kind of create this like lost chapter of comic book history.
I was reading this Starlin autobiography. It's a pictorial autobiography. It's really nice. But there was a mention that when he was doing Invincible Iron Man, not to say it was their best selling title, it wasn't, but there was this note that like Stanley just did not like what he was doing there. And he just, even though like people like me or you, you know, were like, this is cool stuff, you know, but there was this thing where the older editorial guys don't always get what the new guys want or the good new people want to read. Berger was an interesting character because I almost got the sense like it was like a Dick Giordano type of guy, but it wasn't. It was definitely his own character. And I started getting a sense that he was his own character deeper into it. But in the beginning, I got a Dick Giordano vibe from the guy.
Yeah, I could see that. I think I wanted to have a comic book insider that could kind of speak to the industry a little bit, who had come to Triumph with high hopes and was a little broken by the process. Like, there's one line where he's like, you know, I was hired to do my job and my boss's job. Like, I think a lot of people can sometimes relate to that idea you're doing your work, but also you kind of have to make your boss look good. And so he was doing the part of the editor-in-chief's job that Carlisle just didn't want to be bothered with, like, you know. And so it was fun to have him there and also to craft a friendship between him and Carmen that wasn't just like mentor mentee. Like, they are definitely equals and they come together and talk about comics in a fun way. And that scene, you'll appreciate this, like, a big thing about the book for me was creating the sense of atmosphere of working in comics and verisimilitude. Like, if you're reading it and like you or I were a big comics people, you could read it and be like, oh cool, there's a nod to this, or there's an Easter egg there. And if you're a casual reader, maybe you're making notes and thinking, oh, I need to read Steve Gerber, or I need to read Jim Starlin.
Totally. So I tried, like, you know they're being Wikipedia during
while they're being But one of the things for me is I didn't want to default into like Wikipediaing these people. Like, I didn't want it to be like, well, Carmen, Jim Starlin was born in so-and-so and, you know, Walt Simonson.
Yeah, because it's a fictional narrative. You shouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. But the one time I did take a little bit of a detour, and I think it worked, is when Carmen is in Berger's office the first time and they're talking and he hands her comics every now and again, as not as an education, but more as like a book trade. Like, these are things that I liked and I think you'll like them too as like a comic fan. And he hands her the first Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams Batman comic.
Yeah.
And obviously we're playing the hits there. Like, it's such a iconic story, but I went into a little more detail there talking about how important that run was, or not really.
And how it made Batman dark again, something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it returned him to his roots as like this dark Avenger. Yeah. And so that was fun. I mean, I had a blast writing the book. It was really like, I had no complaints during the journey. As hard as writing a novel is, you know, you get lost in the weeds sometimes, but it was so fun, not just from comics, but from New York, from a music perspective. It was really fun.
And there was some references, which I found interesting. The Kurtzberg Avenue, Liebert Lane, right, would be kind of thrown in there. And I almost, although they were, names of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, maybe I'm reading into it, but maybe they were also references within the context of the conversation, because you mentioned it overtly, I think later down the road, of the creator not getting credit for contributing to writing a story. And maybe those names were mentioned as a insider kind of hint toward the concept, because later you did write that phrase that Jack Kirby didn't get a lot of writer credit for those stories.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, the tragedy here is that when you read Secret Identity, you're not feeling like Carmen is the sole person ever wronged by the comic book industry in terms of getting credit or or controlling their IP or creation. So, you know, there are a lot of, you know, I drew inspiration from a lot of real stories, like, and obviously Kirby's story, Bill Finger's story was hugely influential in this idea of like creating an iconic character in secret. Like Bill Finger, like that saga has been chronicled in many different ways. But yeah, as for like Lieber and Kurtzberg, you know, I think that was more just like a fun nod, but you probably caught the echo that was subconscious for me while writing it.
Now, it's not just the comics, although another pop culture reference I want to bring up. I love that you mentioned that there the 1975 New York convention of comic art and Walter Gibson and Jack Kirby on a panel together. You mentioned that in the story, because in 1975, Walter Gibson was making rounds at comic conventions. And that's actually where there are a lot of photos of Jim Steranko and Walter Gibson together at conventions in 1975 specifically. Yeah. They also set up like a shadow club of some kind in 75. But it's just cool that 75 and how you brought the Walter Gibson stuff in there at the Commodore Hotel, you know, cockroaches, rats or whatever was being referenced. It really did evoke the sense of being there for me.
Oh, good.
I've talked with people who were there, you know.
It's so funny because, and I'm sure we'll get into the comic book sequences in a bit, is I sent Sandy Gerrell, the artist who did the comic sequences, the draft of the novel so he could read and then do the interstitial parts. And he was at that show. He was at that 1975 show. And he was like, well, so it's almost like he ran into Carmen as well. But I also felt like it would have been a missed opportunity if I didn't note something like, you know, Gibson and Kirby together, because it is literally, that's what the book is about. It's a blend of pulp and noir and superhero comics. And that felt like such a natural fit and just like, you know, pure coincidence, but also the kind of coincidence you can't ignore.
Those are founding fathers of a lot of the comic fiction that we read, even though Walter Gibson's foray in comics was more of like these random magician comics in the 40s and early 50s. But it was his work on the Shadow that a lot of Batman, you know, came from with Bill Finger.
And there's a lot of echoes to like Patricia Highsmith, who's one of my favorite crime writers, but she also wrote a lot of Golden Age comics anonymously. And so there's echoes of that in there. You know, at one point, without spoiling anything, Carmen uses Patricia Highsmith's pseudonym, Claire Morgan, at one point. And yeah, so there's like little,
with that fan, Alfred, that had that. Yeah, I'm not going to describe it. Okay, one thing, and I'm not going to spoil anything about that scene, but there's something about that line that it just danced in my mind was when he was sitting on his couch with one black cat on each side.
It's intense.
I was like, what? I mean, I'm like imagining like this vampire, you know, guy that has this weird, ominous knowledge. And something about that sentence just, I thought it was genius. It really kind of established what a weird guy that is.
Yeah, I mean, and every industry has people like that, like just people that are so passionate about the minutiae of stuff that is amazing to me. Like and that's the thing with all these characters is that I loved writing them, is that you want to follow even the supporting characters, like someone like Marion, who was supposed to just show up in the volleyball game. Like when I wrote her, she was just going to be this mysterious like femme fatale type that shows up in the volleyball game and never to be seen again. And then she becomes this integral part of the last act of the book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now, there's also flashbacks in it, which I found interesting. And, you know, it's not easy to wrap the modern moment into a flashback in novel form. Because in a movie, you clearly know, you know, that the scenery just changed. You're using words to establish the character processing current information while remembering past information. Was that tricky for you to kind of nuance that?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging because you don't want it to just be a chapter break and like, hey, now we're in flashback land and this is what happened. I like to weave it into the present. So there's one scene, I think, when Carmen is, you know, she's had a few drinks and she's feeling dizzy and delirious and she's having flashbacks to Miami and her past relationship. And I wanted to weave it in so she almost becomes like an unreliable narrator at some point. You're just like wondering like what is going through her mind and is she okay? Like she's buttoned up and really put together for most of the book and then she just kind of breaks at that point. And I thought that was really an interesting trajectory to take her down. And I think the challenge with flashbacks is you have to make it count because it's really easy to get lost in flashbacks and just like kind of, you know, pedal aimlessly, but it has to be relevant to the present day story. Otherwise you're just kind of spinning your wheels.
Yeah, that's right. And I think writing a lot of long form stuff, you almost have to sacrifice some extraneous things and delete that and keep it pertinent to keep everyone on track. So
yeah, it's interesting because and this is a testament to my editor, Zach Wagman, who was very smart about keeping it focused and keeping it in Carmen's head, is that in addition to the comic book interludes, we had like historical interludes to the comic press. So the book initially opened up on an almost academic paper from something like the Comics Journal talking about the sad story of Triumph Comics, and then like a Wizard interview with Jeffrey Carlisle in the late 90s. And then there was a scene of Carmen at a comic convention at the end where she, there was just things that didn't make the cut and for good reason, but that I'll probably find a home for somewhere. But it was just sometimes you have to kill your darlings. The cliche is very true.
To keep people on the ride of the whole thing. So then now some more pop culture references that are not comic related, but were important, I felt, to establish the scenery of New York City. I mentioned earlier, you mentioned Velvet Underground and that type of music. I love the Andy Warhol reference because I think a lot of people now almost forget how important he was in pop culture from like late 60s to like early 80s. But 70s, and this is his post-shooting era before, mm-hmm. after he got shot, he was so interrelated with what people were seeing visually in New York City when it came to pop culture and the arts. Tell us about what kind of research you were doing into New York City of the 70s that you were bringing these kind of elements in.
Yeah, so I mean, in addition to, the comic book research and interviews I had to do just to get the comic book stuff right and the Carmen stuff right, I had to really I didn't want it to just feel like, hey, it's New York 1975 and wing it. I wanted it to really feel like you were there. There's a great book called Love is a Building on Fire by Will Hermes, and it chronicles like his youth in the 70s in New York and the music scene, but it's not just the CBGB stuff. It's not just like Max's Kansas City, which is all like that to me is great, but it's also like Latin music and jazz and avant-garde music. I also read a great Lou Reed biography that really focused on that era, the tail end of the Velvet Underground and the seediness of New York, but also the 70s and Lou kind of coming out of his shell and becoming a solo artist. And so I used a lot of that to kind of get a sense of the music scene and also New York, like the texture of New York, that it was very different. Like comics in 1975, New York in 1975 was totally different from the New York of today. It was much more dangerous and, kind of falling apart. It felt like, a lot of people weren't sure the city was going to survive in terms of, financially, structurally. Gerald Ford told New York to go to hell. Like they, drop dead. And so it was just.
And that was also true of just the newsstand comic book industry at that time, because there wasn't this clear cut method of the direct market saving comics. People were thinking that a lot of things about New York, including comic books, were all just going to come to an end soon.
Yeah, it was falling apart. And I think that is in such stark contrast to what we see today, which is fun, which is great. Like, I think the fun of a novel for me is when it takes you somewhere else, like to an industry or a place or a culture that you're not familiar with, and kind of walks you through it as best they can. And so I wanted to feel immersive, but also not like I was rattling off facts to like prove my cred, I guess.
Now, there was also mention of Pedro Fernandez in this story. So is this a shared universe then with your other stuff?
Yeah, a friend of mine joked around because there's also mention to some other stuff like the Black Ghost and the Dusk, and the Freedom Alliance is a team of characters I'm going to be writing in another book. Yeah, like calling it like the Segura expanded universe. But yeah, this all happens in the same world as like Pete Fernandez. There's actually two Pete Fernandez references, like one reference to his dad, and then there's another one that no one has gotten unless I explain it to them. So I won't spoil it for you, but if you read Miami Midnight and then you read Secret Identity and like look at the names, you'll see some connective tissue that is not as obvious. Yeah.
The comic pages, it was interesting because they replaced, there would be like a narrative page of comic art, and there would be some theme that seemed to speak to what Carmen was going through at the time. Tell us about constructing those.
Yeah, so it kind of dates back to reading Cavalier and Clay as a kid, not a kid, I was in my 20s, but reading that book and just loving it because for the first time, I felt like comics were woven into a novel in such an interesting way. It felt like literature and comics were blending together. And comics are, of course, literature in their own way. But I'd never read a comic that I'd never read a novel that explored the industry. And so it felt like it was written just for me. But the one thing I wanted to kind of pull out of it was I had wanted to read the Escapist comics. Like, you're reading the novel and I wanted to read those comics. And later they eventually published them through Dark Horse, which was cool. but I had part of me wish that they were part of the novel. So you're reading the novel and then you get pulled into the comic. And so that idea was always in the back of my mind. So when I knew I was going to do this comic book noir, I knew out of the gate, I told my agent, I was like, we have to have comics in it. And he kind of was like, are you sure? Like, that's a whole like procedural thing. Like, it's not just a prose book. It adds a whole complication to it. But I also knew who I needed to draw it. Sandy Jarrell is amazing. Like he's not just a great artist. He's like a comic book history buff. Like he does these amazing recreations of classic covers. He showed me this Hawkman cover that he did, like a mock showcase cover. And that's when I really knew. I was like, he's the guy, because not only does that feel like something that could have existed, it doesn't feel like he's imitating anyone. You know, I wanted an artist that was going to evoke the era, but not feel like, oh, that's just Sandy like imitating Frank Miller, or that's Sandy imitating like, you know, any artist of the era, like Gene Colan or what have you. And so I talked him through it. I sent him the outline for the novel and a big chunk of the pages, like of the prose. And the interstitials were already there. And the idea was that as you're reading the novel, it's going to pull you into the comics for like a break. Like you get a mental break, but those comic sequences are definitely meant to evoke the mood of the story, because it's Carmen who's creating most of them, except for one. And then...
Well, two, right? It was two issues that were by that other team, right?
Right. Two issues, but like one page that's actually shown.
But one page is shown, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, and so the idea, but I just didn't want it to feel perfunctory. And by that, I mean, like, I didn't want someone to read it and say, oh, he's just got comics in here just to have them. Like, they have no bearing on the story. It's just like showing
off. It has to fit with your narrative.
It has to fit the story, and it has to feel like it adds to the story, so much so that if you just read the prose, you would be missing part of the heart of the story because you didn't get the comics. And so Sandy and I worked Marvel method, where I would give him like a few sentences of story and say, you know, I think this will be two or three pages, you know, show the Lynx jumping over some rooftops. She captures a guy, and then it closes on a close up and she's surprised. And then he would lay it out and we'd go back and forth. And then I would do the script. And then Taylor Esposito, who was the letterer, he figured out a font that made it look like it was hand lettering, which I was blown away by because it just looks so of the time. And like I said, I didn't want it to feel like someone imitating, like someone's riffing on like a retro take, but, you know, like something that could have existed at that time.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was very effective.
You're the target audience for the authenticity of that.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I also like, you know, the little Bendy kind of approach on the dots. The question, the thing that I would kept paying attention to though was the credits on the bottom.
Okay.
I kept who's credited on that page?
Yeah,
and I'm like, damn it, it's not her yet. Like I was feeling it, and then you would see like uncredited, and I'm like, I like how that developed along with the events in the story, that I just kept, you know, I'd read the page, and you know, I liked the, you know, I liked what it did narratively, and I liked the character, and I liked the art and all that, and the authenticity of it. The credits, I just kept like, okay. You know,
I put those in there for myself. Like, that's the kind of thing I would look at. So I know that like fellow fans of stuff like that would be looking at those details. Like, you know, like the letterer, Todd Morelli, that's a nod to like Todd Klein and Jack Morelli, like two of the best letterers in the industry. Like, just a little, like little hat tip there. And then there is one sequence, like we were talking about, that is not written by Carmen, not drawn by Doug Detmer. And that's when kind of she totally loses control of the character. They're no longer working off her scripts. Yeah. And you just see the huge tonal shift and how it's unlike anything she did. It lacks the heart or the passion.
Link's number 7. I've memorized the issue.
Yeah,
I've already memorized the issue number. But the interesting thing, I remember when I was interviewing Trina Robbins that one time, we talked about...
Oh, that was a huge influence, that interview.
Oh, it was. Oh, I'm glad. Well, there was this topic that I brought up with her that really fascinated me, was the two different approaches that writers approach a female character. And there is I kind of break it up into the Bill Wagon, Katie Keene approach, which is like, you know, more of a positive character, pro female, pro young female for impressionable young females. And then there is the, you know, the Bill Ward, torchy, kind of fetishized aspect to appeal to the juvenile, sexually obsessed teenagers that would be reading it for some sort of, you know, more of a perverse gratification.
Right.
And I'm not judging one, you know, this versus that. I'm not saying, but I would say though that that was an interesting example of seeing that in your book. It started out as kind of like the Katie Keene aspect, and then it becomes this torchy thing for like two issues, because the creators that weren't intended to write that character then kind of took over that character. And I thought that was really effectively demonstrated. It almost feels like a lot of people who don't know about comics, they're going to learn these funny themes as they go through your book. I almost feel like you're translating a lot of the comic stuff to like a mainstream audience through this mystery novel. And I thought that is just so, I think it's like important, right? It gives people this sense of the industry in a way that's entertaining and fun. Although that's not the primary objective, is to tell a good story, but it does seem to have that secondary function to it, right?
Yeah, for sure. I really wanted to show with that sequence in particular, just how much a comic can change. Like, I think a lot of people, casual, you know, people who aren't into comics don't understand that tonally a whole story can change depending on who's writing or drawing it. And that sounds silly to say on a comic book podcast, but you know, if you're not a comic person, you just think comics are produced and they're just churned out, and that's how
a lot of people don't know that there's different versions of Superman.
And so like something like The Lynx, that was a passion project for Carmen, a passion project for Detmer, suddenly gets handed to two hacks, for lack of a better term,
who are
cranking it out and obviously are going for the lowest common denominator. It's a big shift. It's a total shift in the content and the intent. Right. And so I wanted to show that and really kind of get to the gut of what sometimes happens with comics. You know, I got to send the book to Trina Robbins, and I obviously was very indebted to her work. I'm looking at some of her books on my shelf now.
Yeah.
But it was that interview you guys did that really added a lot of texture to the brainstorming for the book. And, you know, the podcast is thanked in the acknowledgments, but there were so many interviews that, you know, it's not like you guys were doing a lot of the work for me, but you spoke to a lot of people that I wanted to speak to already.
Oh, cool.
And so it got a lot of texture from like your conversations.
What were some of the other interviews you would say were some sort of influence in this?
The Trina Robbins one, obviously, the long one you did with Paul Levitz. I mean, I've known Paul for a long time and I consider him a good friend. But that really gave me a kind of a 101 on his career that I didn't really know off the top of my head. You did spotlights on some of the smaller publishers like Atlas Seaboard, which I found fascinating. Yeah. And I think there was one on Harvey Harvey Comics, where it wasn't so much about the content, but like this idea of a, you know, C-level or B-level publisher and how they existed during that time, that I found really fascinating.
Yeah, and how they were so incompatible with the direct market of the 80s.
Yeah, it just kind of fell apart, yeah.
Yeah, at that point, it's not the newsstand anymore, so it's not about a random kid walking by. It's about 13-year-old boys that want violence and sex at their comic shops. And that,
exactly, they don't want the casual like cartoon stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Warren Magazine seemed to fall apart for a similar reason.
Yeah, I mean, I really just, the podcast became like this assistant. You know, like you guys did so much research talking to so many key figures in the industry that it was really helpful to like tap into that, for sure.
That's really great. Much appreciated. Thank you so
of course.
Much for mentioning that, mentioning us in your acknowledgments. Mm-hmm. That was very kind.
For sure.
Another couple of historical precedents to the concept of another creator coming in, because you even mentioned in there that sales had like spiked up actually with a new...
Yeah.
When Romita took over for Ditko, that's another example of maybe the intent of the auteur being changed, but then the sales responded positively to it. Although I love that, and that's not fetishized, but it's different.
Totally, yeah, just so totally different from what Ditko was doing.
Yeah. And then another one was Scorpion that Chaykin made for Atlas, how in like the first one or two issues, it was, you know, his Dominic Fortune character. Mm-hmm. But then when he left the book, because Martin Goodman didn't like his stuff, it becomes this other Scorpion, which is like this bouncy guy in tights and so such a lame character. And I almost kind of felt like that happened with the Lethal Lynx in that sense. So there was the fetishized, but then there was also like making it more like a bubblegummy version of the original creator.
Yeah. And it's such a, you know, stuff like that is so common in comics where the tone is so tied to the creator. And if a creator is changed, like you see it also when like Frank Miller becomes writer and artist, like when he's the artist with Roger McKenzie scripting, it still feels like a traditional superhero comic, though the art is different. But then when he takes over as writer, the whole vibe is different. And so I wanted to definitely show how major a change that could be.
Yeah. And you did. Wonderful. And I know we're not going to spoil the end for anybody.
No.
So I think I read like 80% of it in a day just to like, figure out who and what happened, which I thought was really interesting. You touched upon the importance of IP and characters as some sort of bankable product at some point down the line, which I thought was also an interesting take, because I think in the mid 70s, although they knew that,
sort of, yeah,
I don't think they were really, like you said, they weren't really in the cartoons as big of a deal and as in movies. And so I know that Stan Lee, he wanted to push comics into the magazines, and then he was the one that was really going to LA and trying to make these things into TV shows. So in a sense, he knew, although Kirby, I think, created more stuff than he did, but he was important in transferring that material to other media. So
yeah, totally. I think that, yeah, without spoiling anything, that's obvious. That's, you know, the book is in many ways like a meta look at intellectual property and what happens when you lose control and what the value of a character is. And in 1975, I don't think as many people, obviously today, it's all about like, what is the value of this IP? Like, what can it be elsewhere? Whereas back then in comics, it was a little more intangible. So it's a, yeah, I don't want to give away the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe in 5 years, we'll give away the end.
Yeah, we can have a postmortem.
Alex, any further comments you want to make about Secret Identity that people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, at first, at its heart, it's a mystery. It's a mystery novel. It's meant to entertain. My favorite kind of mysteries are the ones that take you somewhere else and show you a world that maybe you've never lived in or you're not familiar with. So I hope that people that love comics get a kick out of it like you and I did, you know, just seeing all the hat tips and Easter eggs and nods to the world we love. But I hope also that people that just read, you know, want to read a fun mystery in an industry that they're not familiar with will enjoy it and maybe come out of it wanting to pick up a stack of comics. And the big thing for me is I wanted to give this sense that maybe somewhere this Triumph Comics existed, and maybe when you're kind of going through your back issues, you'll find an issue of the Legendary Lynx and it won't seem crazy.
There you go. I like it. Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you so much for being
here today,
chatting and being a guest on the podcast. Really great. You know, I know we interact on Twitter quite a bit, and it's nice to finally sit down and go over this and go over your career. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much. It's an honor and a pleasure. You know, I'm a fan of the podcast, and so it's really cool to be a part of it. Thank you.